Marshall, will you call the next case?
Number AAC-1126, State of Minnesota, Respondent versus Thomas Ridley Asmussen, appellant.
Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. Each of you, beginning with you, Mr. Bass, will have 15 minutes for your argument and you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I would ask you to state your name because we are recording this when you come to the podium, which you can lower or raise. So use your discretion about that. So whenever you're ready.
May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Howard Bass, and I represent the appellant in this case, Thomas Agnew. Mr. Agnew was convicted of assault in the second degree in Benton County following a one-day jury trial. This case presents a single issue, and that is whether the district court abused its discretion and denied Mr. Agnew his right to present a complete defense by excluding the testimony of his expert witness, a man named Mark Brewley, who is a use of force expert with extensive training and experience as a firearms instructor. The due process right to present a complete defense includes the right of a defendant to present witness testimony. Mr. Agnew was denied that right in this case based upon the district court's pretrial ruling granting the state's motion to exclude Mr. Brewley's testimony. A hearing was held on that motion on October 26, 2017. At that time, Mr. Agnew's trial attorney made a proffer as to what evidence he would seek to elicit from Mr. Brewley. He specifically told the district court that he was not intending to offer Mr. Brewley's report, which had been furnished to the prosecution pursuant to Minnesota criminal discovery obligations, and outlined the type of testimony that he sought to elicit from the expert witness. It was testimony involving self-defense mental processes and concepts, including spatial and temporal concepts.
Here's my question for you. What element or elements of the self-defense defense would the expert testimony have addressed?
Elements of the defense. Well, whether or not it would have added depth and precision to Mr. Agnew's testimony about what he perceived, about the threat that he assessed.
Add to what he perceived. I mean, it seems to me there's two things at issue here. What he actually saw, in this case, clenched fists is one of the things. But then there's an inference that you draw from clenched fists. How could the expert's testimony have anything to do with the first part there, what he actually saw?
Well, if it wouldn't have any, it would not alter what he saw, but it would assist the jury in processing and understanding what that meant to Mr. Agnew because of the firearms training.
Why would it do that other than suggest an inference that they should draw, that the jury should draw from the evidence?
Because Mr. Agnew was a permit to carry holder. He had gone through the statutorily required training on self-defense.
But this expert didn't train him. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct. The record doesn't indicate, and I honestly don't know whether this...
There's no suggestion that he knew the defendant?
No, but that would go towards the weight and...
Wouldn't what's relevant to the... This is my original question. Wouldn't what's relevant to the self-defense defense be what Mr. Agnew was actually trained in, what his trainer informed him, not what some expert law enforcement trainer use of force, defensive tactics trainer might say, he would have included in his training. Why does it matter that, why would anyone get to expand upon or provide illumination to what was, what information was provided to Mr. Agnew?
It's my understanding that the testimony would have reflected what trainers on the carry, the permit to carry training course are required to train individuals in.
Okay, I looked at the proffer that you're talking about. I didn't see that in the proffer. So what is the, maybe that could be a good starting point. What is the language in the proffer that the district court should have relied upon in saying that this was admissible?
I believe that's at pages 8 through 12 of the motion hearing transcript. Mr. Agnew's trial attorney told the district court that Mr. Brule was going to testify about a mental process when deciding whether or not to defend themselves, the OODA process.
Right. I saw that. Let's take these one at a time. So I saw that, and I thought, well, why would that matter? Why would it matter what the expert believes is the observe, orient, describe, act process, if that was not part of, and we don't know that that was part of the training of the defendant in this case?
My suspicion, Your Honor, is that the standardized, that the training is standardized in order for...
Well, that may be your suspicion, but the district court was never informed of that connection. And so if that's the case, why would the district court speculate that what the expert, if not, if was, if the court wasn't told, why would the district court speculate that the training that Mr. Brule offered is the same training that the defendant received?
Well, I would submit that that's a foundational issue. I don't think it precludes the expert's testimony, but I think it goes to the weight, and it's certainly
It's not relevant unless there is a connection, is it?
Well, Mr. Agnew testified also with very limited testimony about the training that he received in order to get a permit to carry. Again, this proffer is not testimonial. It's just the lawyer telling the district court what he anticipates.
Okay, so I cut you off. You said the OODA, you testify to that. I don't see the connection there, but what else?
Further on, it on that same page, on page 8, the proffer continues that Mr. Brule would testify about something called a 21-foot rule, a concept that an assailant can travel 21 feet and attack someone physically before the person could draw their firearm to defend themselves. These are things that are beyond the knowledge of an average lay jury.
But didn't Mr. Agnew testify about that? And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, even the Rice police chief or Ben on cross?
He did, Your Honor, but I don't believe that that is a constitutionally sufficient substitute for expert testimony. The due process right to present a complete defense includes the right to call witnesses, including expert witnesses.
Right, if they bear on the elements or the issues. So I'm looking at the issues as stated in Nystrom for self-defense, and I'll just quote here from Nystrom. There's four elements. The absence of aggression or provocation on the part of the defendant. Well, the expert's testimony wouldn't go to that. The defendant's actual and honest belief that he or she was in imminent danger. Well, this goes to the subjective perspective of Mr. Agnew, and the expert can't testify to that. The existence of reasonable grounds for that belief. Now, it seems like that's the only place, and the other one is the absence of reasonable possibility of retreat to avoid the danger. It seems like, if I understand this process correctly, it is, and you correct me if I'm wrong, but the defendant has to have an actual and honest belief of imminent of danger of death or bodily injury, and then that belief has to be relevant. There have to be grounds for that belief. So don't we have to get into Mr. Agnew's head, not what the expert thinks might be in somebody else's head?
Clearly, Mr. Agnew would not even have been entitled to a self-defense instruction had he not testified about what was in his head.
Right.
But the expert's testimony can explain what was going on inside Mr. Agnew's head because of the training that he had received in these concepts of self-defense.
The problem I've got, the expert doesn't say he knew the training that Mr. Agnew received. I mean, just because Mr. Agnew says, I learned something about the 21-foot rule. I'm imagining that you could have 15 people describe what that rule means and how it applies, and you'd get 15, you get some variation of what it means. So without getting Mr. Agnew and his instructor, I'm not sure, I'm still lost as to where the logical connection is between the expert's perspective of this training and the standard the jury had to apply.
Based on the record as it exists, and because of the fact I did not represent Mr. Agnew at trial, I cannot tell you whether or not Mr. Brulee was or was not his firearms instructor. But again,
the record doesn't show that he was. So if he was, it would be the burden of Mr. Agnew to have made that connection, or his counsel. So was there anything connecting that you found between the training that Mr. Agnew received and the training that would be described by the expert? Was there a connection made anywhere in the proffer that you're pointing to?
I think the connection can be drawn from Mr. Agnew's limited testimony on direct examination about things like the 21-foot rule and the proffer by his attorney as to what the expert would testify to. And again, I don't believe that admissibility is conditioned on the expert having been the defendant's trainer, but rather connecting it up, the admissibility by showing that he was trained in the same concepts that this expert is testifying about to explain and add depth to his testimony to the jury. In addition to the 21-foot rule, the proffer included an indication of expert testimony with respect to the assessment of pre-attack indicators, which lead to a determination of whether or not force is necessary. That is a determination made subjectively under the circumstances, but based upon the training that he received in assessing a threat and how to react to it.
But on that one, what I don't understand here is he could describe what was happening at the scene. If the jury believed everything that he said happened, that the guy was saying, "What are you going to do now, tough guy?" had his hands clenched, and he was walking quickly towards him. I mean, those are just perceptions that he had. The jury believes he had them. But then in terms of drawing a conclusion, whether that presents any particular threat, why couldn't a jury just do that? What does the expert testimony add to their evaluation of those facts?
Well, in this case, specifically, and that's what the jury did, they had to draw that inference without expert assistance. In this particular case, it would answer the question about why he drew his gun, why he, according to Mr. Agnew, held his gun up to the side of his head, pointed up, because it was consistent with the training. The 21-foot rule comes
into
play.
Okay, but why wouldn't his testimony do that, be sufficient to do that? He said, "I learned in my training course that this is what happens. I reacted the way that my training course said to."
Your Honor, with all due respect, I don't think it's a matter of sufficiency. It's a matter of a defendant's right to present a defense.
Right, but isn't one of the tests here whether the expert's testimony would aid the jury?
Yes.
And I'm trying to understand how this would aid them. I mean, they could just hear what happened, and they can evaluate whether it was reasonable.
Sure, but they have nothing to corroborate Mr. Agnew's testimony about what he claims to have learned and why he acted the way he did without an expert in use of force and firearms training to corroborate that.
That's an excellent presentation of what might have been offered to the district court. I didn't see in the proffer that you were referring to anything close to what you just said. And so if we're going to determine that the district court abused its discretion by excluding the evidence, don't we need an argument that makes the connection that you say we should be making?
Yes, but I disagree with you that it's not contained, the proffer is not sufficient. I think that the district court should have, based upon the proffer that was presented, based upon Rule 704 and its commentary, based upon State versus Henham, the court should have recognized that there is certain evidence that is inadmissible that goes to the ultimate issue. For example, the expert.
When was this hearing?
The hearing was on October.
I mean, in relation to the trial.
Hearing was end of October. Trial was beginning of February.
Okay, so at this point in time, the district court would not know that Mr. Agnew was intending to talk about the 21-foot rule unless the court is informed.
I think that's a fair assumption.
And I see in the proffer that the expert, or the lawyer is saying what the expert says about the 21-foot rule, not that the expert is going to corroborate what Mr. Agnew was learned about the 21-foot rule.
No, but with the expert could have sat could have testified based upon Mr. Agnew's testimony that that's exactly what we train people about.
Mr. Agnew hadn't testified.
Nor had the expert. The expert was barred from testifying completely.
No, I mean, at the time that the district court made the decision to exclude the expert, the district court was informed, this is what the expert's going to say. There's this 21-foot rule, and people should be afraid if people would be reasonably afraid if someone was within 21 feet and posing a danger or a threat or they're acting aggressively. But what you said was the expert would be able to help the jury know in context what Mr. Agnew understood about this 21-foot rule. That seems like the connection that I'm missing. And if the district court wasn't given that connection, how would we on appeal say the district court abused its discretion by not inferring an argument that was never presented to it?
By looking at the memorandum attached to the district court's order, which is page 5 of our addendum, it didn't analyze the admissibility or inadmissibility of expert testimony on that basis. It just simply adopted the state's argument that the expert cannot testify as to whether or not Mr. Agnew acted legally in self-defense.
In other words, the district court didn't address the argument that you're presenting right now. But if the argument wasn't presented to the district court, why would we fault the district court for not making the connection? That's what I'm pressing on.
You wouldn't, but my position is that the district court was presented with it at the motion hearing and abused its discretion by not considering that.
I think you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal, Mr. Bass.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent state of Minnesota. To prevail, appellant must convince the court that the district court below not only abused its discretion, but that the appellant was prejudiced by that abuse of discretion. And he's got the burden to convince this court of both of those. Respondent submits that neither leg has been met here, therefore the court should affirm the district court below and affirm appellant's conviction. Nystrom, State v. Nystrom, a case that I rely on, I think has great language at page 260 discussing self-defense, and it holds, the elements of self-defense are by nature very specific to the person apprehending fear and the very particular circumstances causing fear. Our case law has espoused a thoughtful analysis of the particular circumstances in which defendants have found themselves when allegedly acting in self-defense. There's then some citations to authority, which I won't go into, but then the court picks up, in contrast, the appellant's theory in this case is the exact opposite of our accepted doctrine of self-defense. The appellant's theory is very general, applying to a community rather than to appellant in particular, and is non-circumstantial based on a generalized fear of crime in that community.
And well, the difference, though, I see between Nystrom and this case is in Nystrom you had this generalized fear that, well, it's North Minneapolis. I have to proactively defend myself. If I see a threat, I'm going to act on it. I'm not going to wait because I know there's a lot of crime in North Minneapolis. And so, I mean, that's the theory at trial, but that wasn't the appellant's perspective. That was the expert said that there's a lot of crime and therefore any person should act this way. In our case, you actually have Mr. Agnew saying in trial, he actually was trained with this 21-foot rule. So it's not just some abstract idea that an expert might find you to be in danger if someone is encroaching within that space. He had that same specific, particularized concern that that was lacking in Nystrom. Do you understand my distinction, and do you agree with it?
Absolutely. I agree with that distinction about how those facts applied in Nystrom and how they might apply here. But I'm just quoting it for the general way that courts look at it. We look at the particular circumstances, and here that's not what the expert was going to help the jury figure out, coax out. How would Mr. Agnew reasonably have reacted here? And I think the interplay between rule of evidence 702, 703, and self-defense, I just don't see how the expert's testimony was going to be admissible here.
Was the request for the expert's testimony ever renewed after it became clear that Mr. Agnew himself would be testifying to the 21-foot rule?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't know if there was, you know, something off the record.
On the record. Was there anything on the record?
I'm unaware of any renewed request. Counsel cited to State v. Henum, and yes, in some ways on the surface, Henum is applicable here. But I think when you read State v. Saldana and then State v. Henum, when you read them side by side, it's very clear why the district court ruled correctly in this case. Here I'm on Saldana, it's page 230. The scientific evaluation of rape trauma syndrome has not reached a level of reliability that surpasses the quality of common sense evaluation present in jury deliberations. Then in Henum, this is on page 798 on to page 799, since the theory underlying the battered women syndrome is beyond the experimental stage and has gained a substantial enough scientific acceptance to warrant admissibility. And if you compare where is this self-defense, where do these pre-attack indicators, this is Saldana. We have no evidence indicating how these pre-attack indicators could be or should be applied in any situation. As I pointed out in my brief, how do we know, an aggressive approach here by a 250-pound man, there's some kind of scientific basis to rely on that, some scientific reason that an expert would come in and testify to that.
I have a tangential sort of fact question. Was this case argued to the jury that it did not matter whether the gun was pointed in the air or directed at the victim, or was it argued that you should believe the victim that the gun was pointed twice at him or once?
As I stand here today, I can't answer that question. I reviewed the closing argument for the state, but I...
Well, what about the elements of the offense? Does the defense of the offense, doesn't it just require the display? I mean, does it matter how it was displayed?
Arguably, no, but I think it's an important factor that there was a discrepancy between the testimony of what, you know, the victim...
But it's important to what?
The display. You know, is it a display to pull the gun out and hold it in the sky, or to certainly, if you point it at somebody, you know, that's a display of
it. I'm asking in the context of this 21-foot rule, because I understand the 21-foot rule, because a person doesn't have time to react in time to draw a weapon and to defend himself with a weapon, if a person begins an attack within 21 feet, the person needs to remove the weapon from the holster and just to be safe, not to make a threat, use it in a threatening way, but just to take it out. That's the reason why I'm asking the question as to how this was argued to the jury and what the facts were, if we know. And it sounds like you're saying the theory was presented and you don't know whether the prosecution relied specifically on the pointing of the gun.
I don't, so I should just probably stop talking about that, because I would just be guessing at this point. But I don't, again, we look at, I have a lot of background in DWIs. We've got standardized field sobriety tests. Why do we let officers testify at trial when somebody's on trial for DWI? Why do we allow them to testify? because that first word, they're standardized. There have been people that are not police officers who have looked at this, and they can say, when you have properly performed the horizontal gaze nystagmus test, and when you see 6 out of 6 clues, there's a 77% chance that this person will eventually test at 0.08 or more. We don't have standardized pre-attack indicators here. We've just got a laundry list of factors that a person who has been charged with a crime can then point to and say, well, that's what I relied on. And
there's plenty of cases. Would you agree that, at least if you look in the federal courts, in civil cases where officers are accused of excessive force, officers rely quite extensively on the 21-foot rule and expert testimony about how close a person needs to be in proximity before there is a threat. So, I mean, it seems like that expert testimony comes in and it's been readily admissible in courts in other circumstances.
I can't speak to all of those cases. The case that's cited to specifically by appellant in his brief, USV, it's S-L-O-U-G-H. I'm not sure how that's pronounced, if it's SLU. But the facts in that case are readily distinguishable. There, the defendants were, they were employees of Blackwater, and they were providing private security in Baghdad. Yes, and an expert may need to come in and tell the jury what a person who is providing security in Baghdad in the middle of a war zone, yeah.
Well, I recognize that distinction, but I'm talking about generally in law enforcement. I don't think it's new to anyone in law enforcement, this 21-foot rule, or new to litigation about use of force. So officers rely upon it when defending themselves in civil actions. So is it your position that a defendant can't rely upon it in a self-defense claim in a criminal action, or just that it doesn't apply here with the expert's testimony?
I was pointing only to the laundry list of pre-attack indicators, not the 21-foot rule. That's a concept that police can rely on. But I'm just looking at the clenched fist, the aggressive language. There's any number of factors that could be included in that. And frankly, had the victim in this case had a pistol in his pickup, how would this have gone down? The defendant is walking up the dock. He's swearing at him using aggressive language. And if the victim perceived those were pre-attack indicators, what would prevent him from coming out, pulling a pistol, and then when he sees somebody grabbing at what he thinks it might be a holster? It just seems to me that these pre-attack indicators, there's nothing scientific about them. They're used as a laundry list of things that can be used as after-the-fact justifications. If we get to a point where they are standardized pre-attack indicators and we know that X percent of people with clenched fists and aggressive language, maybe they will go on to provoke somebody or to inflict bodily harm, then an expert can come in and testify about it. But until we get to that point, these pre-attack indicators, I don't think it's in the province of an expert to testify about, and I think the district court was dead on that we're getting into the province of this is not helpful
so
to the jury.
So is the point that these are just not generally accepted by the scientific community? Is that the missing element in your mind?
I don't think it's ever been subjected to, whether it's accepted or not, I don't think it's ever been put to the scientific.
If they've never gone through the process, they can't have accepted it.
Yeah, I don't think anybody's even looked at it. And I don't know, frankly, I don't really know how you could. You'd have to come up with...
We have lots of scientific evidence that I don't really understand how they do it either. But we still admit it once it reaches the level of being accepted within the community.
Correct.
I would assume that police training and lots of other, or military training and all that, this 21-foot rule, I suspect that that people like to know how quickly they have to react to protect themselves. I have no idea whether it's 21 feet or some other distance, but is your point that nobody else knows either, or at least there isn't some demonstration of this being in some accepted rule?
No, again, I want to make a distinction between the 20-foot, 21-foot rule and the whole, I don't know if it's OODA, the OODA. Certainly, that I'm sure that is all stuff that you can do a stopwatch. You can put that to scientific test, and you could prove it.
But it's the pre-tech indicators. Hasn't been done yet, or I'm still not understanding what your point is. It seems to me that if the jury's trying to evaluate if a person reacted reasonably, the distance that they are away would have something to do with that.
Correct.
Now, if somebody has actually demonstrated and it's accepted that 21 feet is some sort of a dividing line of some consequence, it would seem to me that would be worth it for the jury to know. Is your point that nobody has done that, so this really hasn't risen to the level of an expert being able to testify about something that jurors wouldn't actually know? I mean, if somebody's running at me, I would react that this is more of a concern than if they're just walking up to me. I don't have to talk to an expert to do that. But what I'd like to know is there some sort of a dividing line here that an expert can say, yeah, at that point, it does become an urgent matter, or does that just not exist? That information just doesn't exist.
It
wasn't offered in this case.
With respect to the 21-foot rule, I would assume or presume that there is evidence supporting that.
So was that presented in this case? I mean, was the district court informed that there is, in fact, some scientific basis or some objective basis to say that 21 feet matters?
During the proffer at the motion hearing, no. None of that information was presented to the... There was just statements by the attorney representing appellant below that this is the information that he anticipated the expert would testify about. But any of the underlying, no, there was no testimony about that.
So then you're asking us and saying there's not enough scientific validity to the expert's specialized knowledge and pre-attack indicators. You're asking us then to kind of make the decision in favor of the state based upon something that wasn't even argued to the district court below? I mean, if the state wasn't there saying, well, there's not scientific knowledge to support this, I thought they were just saying this is within the, you know, purview of, you know, what normal jurors can understand, so it's not helpful.
This court can affirm on grounds that were not argued below.
So, and that's the ground you're asking us to affirm on?
Yes, on this specific point. And I see my time is up. If I can just respond. The court can affirm on any grounds that supports the district court's decision, and I think this argument supports the district court's position. All the questions that the panel has posed to appellant's counsel about the specifics about how does the evidence that the expert was going to present, how would you tie that into Mr. Agnew, all of those arguments apply as well. I was just adding a different gloss on top of that, and that doesn't even get into the inability to prove prejudice.
May I ask one more question before you sit down, if the presiding judge will permit me. I'm conceptually the elements of self-defense are in some ways subjective, in some ways objective, and I'm trying to get a sense about this element. You were talking a few moments ago about whether this is an urgent matter at some point, and is this in the abstract on this test? Do we ask, should the jurors ask, was there an urgency in this case based upon what was in Mr. Agnew's head and what he knew? Or is it in the abstract, any person should have been in fear in this circumstance because of the distance or whatever the circumstances? What is the test?
Well, I think as you discussed it, it's the interplay between two and three. The first, the defendant has to, you know, feel that the defendant actually had a fear. And then three, was that fear reasonable under all of the circumstances? So there needs to be a demonstration of both to a certain extent in order to prevail on that
self-defense. So if this 21-foot test or whatever you call it, this principle comes in, you would agree that it would come in under number three?
Yes.
On the Nystrom list of elements?
Yes, and it did come in. It came in through the chief of police and through Agnew as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Picking up where Mr. Magnuson left off, it did come in, but not in a constitutionally adequate manner. The Chief Hammond, if you look at that, where it came in the transcript, it's nothing, it's cross-examination, and the defense counsel is essentially testifying. The prosecutor objected on that basis, and the chief is just confirming. Most of the answers are yes.
Mr. Best, here's my big picture problem with that. You're talking about the importance of having the complete defense, including the right to put on expert testimony. And yet, I look at these words from the Minnesota Supreme Court that says, look, you have to use great caution when admitting expert testimony in criminal cases.
That's correct.
So there is a real balance we need to make there. So tell me, what expert testimony admitted in a criminal case, not in civil cases and, you know, not just in cases in the newspapers, but, you know, a case that we can look and say, this proposed expert testimony is most like X, whether that's the battered women's syndrome or some of the gang testimony that has been permitted. What's it most like?
I think it's most like the battered women's syndrome evidence in Henham, in that you can present describe the general syndrome and the characteristics. In this case, Brule would have been able to testify about the 21-foot rule, OODA, the training that Agnew received, things like that. But you can't go to the $64,000 question. That was the problem in Saldana, because the expert was permitted to testify, based upon all this, this person is a rape victim. And in Henham, they said the expert was not allowed to testify that the particular defendant suffered from battered women's syndrome. And the reason for that, it bears out if you look at 704, the last sentence of Minnesota Rule of Evidence 704 and the first, the commentary, it's because of the concern that an expert in a criminal case can usurp the jury's duty. And there are concerns about invading the jury's province, offering a legal opinion in legal issues or mixed issues of fact and law, and providing an undeserved stamp of legitimacy to a self-defense claim.
Well, why wouldn't some testimony saying that a person within 21 feet is very dangerous usurp the jury's role in deciding whether it was reasonable to react in this particular instance?
It wouldn't. It would inform the jury. It would give them information. It would be helpful to the jury.
Why wouldn't it be telling them to conclude that it was reasonable?
Because it just says, because it doesn't go, it doesn't ask or answer the ultimate question of whether or not under these circumstances the defendant legally acted in self-defense. It provides the jury with information under which they can analyze whether the Nystrom factors.
I still don't understand, though. What information would it give them? I mean, if you ask all the people in this room how far is 21 feet, I bet we'd have a great range of distances. So what would it actually tell the jury?
It explains to the jury what Agnew did in this case based upon his training, why he engaged in the actions that he did, why he thought it was necessary for him to engage in the actions that he did.
But what if his training had said if someone's within 50 yards, it's what he did was reasonable?
Well, the jury would be free to accept or reject that. But the training in and of itself doesn't tell the jury that this is self-defense as a matter of law. It just gives them additional information that they can use to engage in that analysis. Expert testimony, is, as Judge Ross pointed out, is common in self-defense cases involving law enforcement, use of excessive force. I think we're going to see more and more of these types of claims by people like Mr. Agnew, who have permits to carry. Because like law enforcement officers, they've received some training, clearly not as much, but the training that they've received with respect to the use of force to defend themselves becomes relevant in their use of that force in raising a self-defense case.
And I can understand how that would apply to the question of whether they actually believed it. But what to take the next step and say was what he believed a reasonable thing to believe, isn't that for the jury to decide?
Ultimately, yes. And that's why, and that's what happened in this case. The state said, we don't want Brulee coming in and telling the jury Agnew acted in self-defense. And it was on that basis and that basis alone that the district court granted the state's motion and excluded his testimony.
Thank you very much. Thank you both so much for your arguments and helpful briefing. The case is taken under advisement and we'll issue a decision in 90 days.